We were finishing up with Gregory the Seventh last time when we were together. And you remember he was one who very strongly pushed the power here of the papacy. And in some of these decrees, for example, that he put out, he claimed for the Pope that he's the only man whose feet princes must kiss. Princes must kiss the feet of the Pope. He is one who can depose emperors. A sentence passed by him cannot be reversed. He can be judged by no one. No one can sit in judgment on the Pope. The Roman Church has never erred, nor will it err until eternity. These are claims, see, now being made by Gregory, very strong. And he said the Pope may absolve subjects of their allegiance to evil princes. So if there's an evil prince, the Pope can simply say, you no longer have to obey him. You no longer have to do anything he says. And so he could undercut the power of a prince. You remember there was this confrontation between Henry the Fourth and Gregory, and it was kind of a high point here up until this time of the power of the Pope, where you have Henry the Fourth, who is the head of the greatest Western Empire, standing outside, remember, outside the castle of Canossa there, begging mercy. 3 days he stands outside. There was snow on the ground. It was cold. He stood there with his head bare and bare feet, begging for mercy from the Pope. Now, actually, Henry ended up on top. In that, later on, you remember, some of Henry's enemies got into a contest with him and elected a rival king. And the Pope, Gregory, sided with the rival king, and Henry ended up defeating him. And then Henry puts forward a rival Pope, and Gregory is then deposed, and he dies in exile in Salerno. But he was quite a striking figure and had a tremendous impact, you remember, even before he became Pope, as Hildebrand, and in back of a number of popes. So there we have Gregory. Now we're on this section here dealing with some of the attempts, the papal attempts to reform the church. Because there were some of these men, and Gregory here is one of them, who had felt very strongly that somehow we've got to reform this thing. Now they wanted more power in the papacy, and they also wanted to have moral reform. They were going to tighten up as far as the clergy was concerned. They didn't want the practice of simony continued. Who knows what the practice of simony, or sometimes it's pronounced simony. What is that practice? This was prevalent. Okay, Christy? All right, buying church offices. In other words, a person would say, you know, I'd really like to be the Archbishop of Milan. The Pope would say, or we'll say other dignitaries would say, well, how much will you give for it, you know? Because there are a lot of benefits, almost like buying political office, because in many cases, the church office and political office were so intertwined that in many areas, the church official was the political leader. So that there was an attempt here, under Gregory, and later as well, to reform this practice, and also to bring in morality among the clergy. So many of the clergy were living with concubines or just living very open, immoral lives, so that some of these popes had a sincere desire to kind of elevate the tone. Now, another one we have after Gregory was Pope Urban II. We'll mention him, 1088 to 1099. And he was from a noble family. He was well-educated. His dates as pope were 1088 to 1099. He was a monk at a monastery of Cluny for a while, so he had this in his background. And he was made a cardinal by Gregory the Seventh. And then when he became Pope, he followed the tradition of Hildebrand, or Gregory the Seventh, as he became later, with a tremendously strong emphasis on papal authority and a moral reform. He says, we're not going to allow the clergy just to keep acting this way. You've got to have high character. We're going to insist on these things. Celibacy. You're going to be a clergyman. You're going to be a bishop, a deacon, a presbyter, whatever it is. There is going to be morality. And you remember Urban II here was the one who initiated the First Crusade. And in 1095, at the Council of Clermont, he launched that First Crusade. And he re-emphasized papal authority and also re-emphasized the need for morality among the clergy. So when we think of papal reform here, don't think of it as meaning the papacy now is saying, well, we're going to go back to the simplicity of the early church and I want to give up some of my powers as the pope. These that were moral popes were those who were very strong men, and they were insisting more and more on the power of the papacy, and perhaps thinking sometimes that was needed to reform and to have these conditions that they felt need to be changed. Now, another strong pope is Innocent III. Innocent III, from 1198 to 1216. 1198-1216. We're just picking out some of these that stand out here. And he was born in 1160 from an aristocratic family near Rome. So he came from a good background as far as his family was concerned. He was educated in France, in Paris, and he had a very good education. In fact, he was generally esteemed as one of the most learned men of his day. Now, some of the popes were not that learned, but here was one who was a real student and scholar. He was made a cardinal at the age of 29, so you can see he was really showing promise. It was said of him that he was marked by singleness of purpose, by an iron will, very strong-willed man, and great executive and diplomatic ability. He was a very hard worker. He drove himself. And he, too, had a very strong emphasis on papal power. These popes through this period were marked by, many of them, by being very, very strong in their desire and will to rule and to govern, and some of them were very able men. And actually, Innocent III exercised more power in political affairs than any pope before him and than any pope since. He was kind of the peak here of, should we say, the popes being involved in political affairs, because he had his finger just about in everything that was going on throughout Europe. And kings, if they wanted to get along, really listened to what Innocent III said. For example, Philip Augustus of France, King of France, who was one of the strongest rulers in Europe, was compelled by Innocent III to take back his divorced wife. He just divorced his wife. He wanted some other woman. And Innocent III here said, nothing doing. You go ahead and take her back. And the King of France said, yes, sir. He took her back. So that you can see the power here of the Pope. And then he got into a real hassle with King John of England over the Archbishop of Canterbury. King John wanted to put his man in. And Innocent III had his own choice. And so there was a real fracas, and it ended up with Innocent III excommunicating King John and deposing him, saying, you're no more King of England. And John getting all shook up and submitting and coming scraping and bowing to the Pope and surrendering his kingdom to the Pope And then the Pope giving it back to him and saying, okay, you can be king as my vassal. Just check with me on anything you do. And so you can see the tremendous influence he had. And he had power in other nations as well. He had his finger in all the kingdoms there of Western Europe. And tremendous influence. Innocent the Third. So that even though, now Gregory the Seventh in a way was more outspoken, I suppose you'd say. You know, he just blasted away at Henry the Fourth, and Henry the Fourth would blast away at him. Whereas Innocent the Third here was a little bit more tactful, should I say. He was more diplomatic. But he knew how to work things. And he had the governments of Western Europe just pretty well dancing his tune. And so that he marks here kind of a high point, really, of what you could say political involvement for the Pope. Now, you have, after this period, you sort of have a decline in papal power. After Innocent III, it goes on, just a gradual decline. None of the popes following here have quite the force or power that Innocent III. And this goes on for about 200 years. And during part of this time, we have what is spoken of as the Babylonian captivity. When from 1309 to 1377, the popes resided at Avignon. This was near France and dominated by France, basically, instead of by Italy. They were out of Rome. Why do you suppose it was called the Babylonian captivity? Well, it's roughly a period of 7 years when they were away from Rome. Even as Israel, you remember, was 7 years in Babylon. And so you have this period of time when the seat now of the Pope was at Avignon. And all of the popes during this period were French, not Italian. There was a change here. You had a stress on luxury. The popes and the archbishops, the cardinals, would sort of trying to outdo one another as to their palaces and their residences, just like St. Peter did. And with this, at times you had some popes that would try for some reform, but with little success. It was a period of time when, really here, you have the papacy losing power and no longer as dominant as it was under some of these very, very strong popes, such as Gregory the Seventh and old Urban the Second and Innocent the Third and some of the others in between them. But these are just some of the outstanding ones. Now, let's think about, during this period of time, you have what I call sort of splinter reform movements. Remember, there were attempts to reform within the church especially. What are some of these? All right. That's good, Cheryl. The monastic movements. You have many of these movements arising, don't you, during this period. And you have the Franciscans, you have the Dominicans, you have various others, such as the monastery, Cluny. And you have attempts to reform, still keeping within the structure, still, you know, giving authority to the Pope, seeking papal blessing, no thought here of breaking away. And then you have the popes themselves now attempting to purify the church, should we say morally, as far as their ideas about the clergy, what a moral clergyman is. They wanted to elevate the moral tone of the clergy. But now we're getting into some movements that didn't stay within. They splintered, they broke off. And one of these is the Waldenses. Waldenses. And the origin of the name is a little bit uncertain. Some have suggested that maybe it's from shaded valleys, Valles Densa. But perhaps more likely it's from Peter Waldo, who was the founder, you could say, of this movement. Peter Waldo. Now, this is an important movement in church history, and it persisted for a long time. And there are still some of these Waldensian congregations persisting. Now, Peter Walder was a rich merchant in Lyon, France. And he really began thinking about spiritual things, and he became really impressed with the shortness of life, the brevity of life, the uncertainty of life, and he became concerned. I want to really know how to live for God and to please God. He was concerned here. So he went to a theologian, and he asked him the way to heaven, and the theologian told him what Christ, you remember, told the young man. If you will be perfect, go sell that which you have and give it to the poor. And so he took this to heart, and in 1176 he paid his debts, paid all his debts, and got rid of his business. He first of all provided for his family. He wanted to make sure they were taken care of. And he gave the rest to the poor. And then he, from that time on, he lived by begging for his daily bread. There were a lot of these groups, you remember, that went around this way, the Franciscans and others. And there were just many that were just independent, that would just float around, and they just lived off others. Openly begging. Openly, you know, carrying a bag or something like this, a pan, a container, to beg money. It was thought that this was perhaps the most spiritual way to serve the Lord. Now, he studied the New Testament very diligently. He had a translation into his own language, and he studied this very diligently. And this movement is marked by a study of the Word.
He translated it earlier.
No, it was already translated. There was a vernacular translation. And he decided to just travel and preach Christ. He says, I want to be like Christ. He traveled around. He went to the different villages and towns, and he preached, and he says, I'm going to do that. And so he attracted followers. And these people, at first, many of them were called the poor in spirit or the poor men of Lyon. They travel around, and people would say, oh, these are the poor men of Lyon. Because they looked poor, and they were poor. They just would wear the clothes they had on, dress very simply and poorly. In some ways, they were a lot like the movement Francis of Assisi started, you remember. Somewhat the same philosophy. Now, the Archbishop of Lyon came down on them, and he forbade them to preach. He says, this has got to stop. You're not ordained clergy. You don't have permission. You don't have church permission at all. This has to stop. Well, they kept on. But they wanted to get permission. Peter Waldo appealed to the Pope. And the Pope said, well, okay. We'll give you limited permission, but you've got to clear it with the local bishop. And the problem was, oftentimes the local bishop wasn't very favorable. And they just keep on preaching. Well, this made the clergy get really unhappy. They requested permission of the Third Lateran Council in 1179. They said, give us permission as men to go out, as laymen to go out and preach. But the council denied this permission. Well, they said, okay, you won't give us permission, we're going to preach anyway. So they persisted in this preaching. And finally, in 1184, the Pope excommunicated them. He said, the whole movement is off bounds. Have nothing to do with them. They're heretics. Now, they didn't stop. They didn't get too shaken by this. They claimed Christ's authority. They just kept on preaching. Their concern was to follow the New Testament. So they read the New Testament a lot. They were marked by memorizing parts of it. Memorized lots of the scripture. And when they went out preaching, they went out in twos, very simply dressed, and they were marked by a refusal to obey clergy. The Pope or bishop or anyone else, we're not going to listen to them. We're going to preach. And they emphasized the fact that laymen could preach. So quite revolutionary in these days. They also began, as they read the New Testament, to discover that all things were not quite according to the New Testament in the Catholic Church. And so they began to preach that masses and prayers for the dead are useless. Somebody dies, don't pay the priest to say prayers or to offer masses. None of these things will help. Further, they said, there's no purgatory beyond this life. Any purgatory you have is here. You go through suffering here. You go through circumstances here. These are the things that will purge you as a Christian and cleanse you. There's nothing hereafter. No purgatory hereafter. And they said, this business of having prayers and church services in Latin is no good. People ought to understand what they're praying and what they're hearing. And so there was a strong stress on everything being spoken in the language of the people. And they said, as far as priests and bishops, don't listen to any of them unless they obey Christ. If they obey Christ, okay, go along with them. And that's fine. But just because he's a priest means nothing. If he's a godly priest, if he's obeying the word of God, then you listen to him, you obey him. Which, of course, is very contrary to what the church was stressing. And they said a layman is as competent as a priest to hear confession. You don't have to go to a priest to say confession. You want to confess your sins? Just confess it to any Christian. He can listen to your confession. They'd have the breaking of bread, the Lord's table together. And they'd say any layman can administer. Although they did have their own clergy. They sort of set up their own clergy within their ranks. They had bishops and priests and deacons. But still, they did emphasize the priesthood of all believers. And they said, any layman can stand up and pass the bread and the cup and so forth. Now, this movement spread widely. There were a lot of people kind of very unhappy and really in the church. And so this movement spread widely in France, Spain, Italy, and Germany. Especially the north of Spain and the north of Italy and the south of France, this area right through there, and in through the Alps. And they stressed very much godly living and morality, a very strong practical stress. Now, divisions did arise among them, and the Roman Catholic Church was a little bit at loss. Now, how do we handle this? And at first, they tried persuasion. They tried to plead with them to come back in the fold, some of our separated brethren here. We want them to return to the fold. And so they tried to persuade them to come. And some did. And the rest they really persecuted. They put pressure on them. And we'll notice some of that pressure in a little bit. But when they were persecuted, some of these Waldensians hid out in the mountains of northern Italy, in the Alps there. And they persisted for centuries there. In through the time of the Reformation. So you did have these in the north of Italy. And of course, there are still some Waldensian churches today. So that it was a movement that we would say is basically orthodox, but it's anti-church. It was anti the established church. But basically orthodox. As far as this went. Now, this isn't to say that the gospel was always clearly presented. Sometimes a very strong stress almost, on works, this kind of thing. But a strong stress on the need for practical, godly living. They were down on this business of all the immorality among the clergy and so forth. Now, there's another movement arises about the same time that's really heretical. And these were called Albigenses, or Cathari. Albigenses, A-L-B-I-G-E-N-S-E-S. The word Cathari meaning pure. And the word Albigenses coming from Albi, a town in southern France that was one of their headquarters. And so this was where they got their name. And these spread through pretty much the same area that the Waldenses did. In other words, through southern France and northern Spain and northern Italy, largely in the 12th century, in the 1100s. C-A-T-H-A-R-I, Cathari. Now, they were heretical in that they went back to this old dualism. There are two eternal powers, they said, one good and one evil. And the evil power created everything material. Everything you can see, everything material was created by this evil power. Matter is basically evil. The human body is evil. This which you cannot see, the spiritual world, was created by the good power. They also said, of course, there are two churches, basically two churches, Rome, which is evil, and our own, which is good. Well, you can imagine this didn't go over too well with the Roman Catholic Church. In their group, they had two levels, really, of people. They had some that were more or less what you call sympathizers or believers. And these were those who didn't really get involved and go all the way with their teaching. And then they had another group that were called those who are perfect. Those who are perfect. And these are the ones now that are really the gung-ho spiritual ones as far as they were concerned. They went all the way. To get into this position, they would have a spiritual kind of baptism, a ceremony, where that would be administered by someone who was one of these who are perfect. And then the person who entered into this, should we say, this inner realm, was expected to live a certain way. He received forgiveness when he did this. And now from this time on, he must live a good life. Now what was it to live a good life? Well, it was to avoid the material world in many ways. Be a vegetarian. No meat, eggs, fish. Because, now, of course, they were a little simplistic in their outlook here. They said these are things that we get by reproduction. They're thinking here sexual reproduction. And sex was wrong. So that here to be spiritual, you wouldn't eat anything such as meat or eggs or fish. And there was to be no sexual activity among these who are perfect. If a man was married, he had to put his wife away and live separately. So you can see a very ascetic and legalistic outlook in these areas. They would never be involved in war, and their point was, to be perfect, you should own no property. They had no church buildings. As far as Christ was concerned, they said he had no real body. He couldn't have a body because the body's sinful. But matter is sinful. It's created by this evil God, this evil power. So Christ didn't have a real body, and he didn't really die. And when they would meet together, they would read scripture, they'd have some common meals, and then they had some clergy within their own ranks. Now, basically, what kind of a religious system is it then, as far as achieving salvation? What is it really, basically, would you say? Alright, there isn't grace here. There isn't the work of the atonement. The cross isn't preached. It's basically you get back to works, isn't it? You practice the right diet and you abstain from these things and you do the right things and then maybe you'll make it. Now, there was a tremendous reaction here as far as the church was concerned. They were concerned to suppress this heresy. Because sometimes too, you see, the church was so involved in politics that sometimes some of these rulers, even petty rulers, would get involved in a heresy as a way of almost, you'd say, casting off the control of Rome. And you notice some of this later too in the Reformation. And so you had some, especially in the south of France here, certain areas that adopted some of these heresies, especially thinking of the Albigensian movement. And the Pope here, in order to crush this, different popes began to encourage wars against these areas that were being saturated with these heresies. Go in there and wipe them out. It's heresy, it's evil. The only thing to do with leprosy is exterminate it, get rid of it. Today we'd say you have to cut a cancer out of a person. And so they were ruthless in this. They said that this thing is evil, it's wrong, they're denying the authority of the Pope and have false teaching. Go in there and by force stamp it out. So armies were used. For example, Innocent III launched crusading armies against heresies in the south of France. Just go into these villages, if there's heresy there, wipe them out. Either they recant, or else that's it. And during this period of time, too, you have the Inquisition being launched. Now, when you think of the Inquisition, what do you think of? Craig? Think of Don Quixote. What do you think of when you think of the Inquisition? What was the point of the Inquisition? What's the goal of it? What were the methods of it? Inquisition. All right. Now, they wouldn't have put it really the exaltation of the church. They would say the exaltation of the Lord. But the point is, heresy was to be dealt with forcibly and with very strong measures. And in this process, you have a council, for example, in 1229, really systematizing this process and encouraging it. And you have the Dominicans very active in the beginning as those who were active in teaching and defenders of the faith, this kind of thing, teachers of doctrine. All right, they were in a position to question a man. Does he hold true teaching? If not, let's bring him around. If need be, use torture. It's better to save a man's soul, and if need be, if you have to destroy his body in the process, but his soul must be saved. So put him on the rack. And just keep putting the pressure on until he recants. He must recant this because this heresy will damn him, see? So it wasn't really voluntary religion. But it was very systematic, and the Roman Catholic Church, because of its political hold and its religious domination, really put pressure here on these movements so that by 1350, most heresies were largely stamped out. By 1350, most of these heresies were largely stamped out. You had some little communities of Waldenses hiding up in the valleys of the Alps. But as a whole, the Roman Catholic Church was pretty successful. They wiped out, these movements throughout this area in general that were against, contrary to the Roman Catholic Church. Gary?
The Inquisition now, is that one particular time interval, like maybe the last 20 years, or is it for an extended period of time? What's the difference between that and the Spanish Inquisition?
Well, during this period of time, now, of course, the process of Inquisition, the idea was one that persisted. But it was especially during this period when it was, should I say, really systematized by the council in 1229, through about 1350, was a time here of the tremendous use of this, and also, at times there before this, also there were, wars against the community where they just go in and by the sword just wipe out a community that was, we'll say, just infiltrated with this teaching, where the whole group would be accepting a false teaching. But the principle of the Inquisition, you see, persisted in the thinking. If the church is right, if the church is the only way of salvation, why then the end justifies the means. What is the end to save a man's soul? Well, if putting him on the rack until he recants will save its soul, it's worth it. And so, many men's thinking, you know, are really twisted here by this. Well, it persisted on into, you see, the north of Spain had a lot of this going on, and a lot of the heresies back in here. So you did have periods of Inquisition persisting. Now, let me touch quickly on the theology here of this period. You have what is called scholasticism, very strong during this period. You have schoolmen in the various universities, as they were called, and Paris was a chief center. It was the big, strong university center. And one of the main discussions that they would be involved in here was to ascertain the relationship of faith and reason. They weren't hashing over some of these problems the church had dealt with earlier, such as, you know, how are the two natures of Christ related, or how is the humanity and deity of Christ related. These weren't issues so much as, what about faith and reason? Is revelation consistent with reason? Which has priority? Is my reason have priority, or is faith have priority? And can reason really demonstrate as true what Christians believe about God? Or are these just two separate realms, you know, and never the twain shall meet? If there's a conflict in my thinking, which do I follow? Now, these are still problems today, aren't they? In the thinking of some people. I'm going through Genesis. Well, that's in conflict with my textbook on biology. Which do I follow? Is there a reconciliation? Are they just two separate spheres, and I study biology in one area and follow the teaching and general beliefs there, and then I study the Bible in another area, and there's no need to try to make a reconciliation. So these were areas that they were struggling through. And Greek philosophy was used a lot. And you had two main schools of thought here. You had Plato with his realism and his emphasis that general terms represent reality. In other words, the idea of a table is the real thing. Tables are simply copies of that idea. They're not the basic reality. And then you had another school of thought, of course, where they emphasized the particular things called nominalism. And they would say, no, that's all wrong. The idea isn't real at all. It's the object. It's a table. It's real. The idea of a table is just your mental concept of that thing. The real things are the material objects you see. And so you have these two basic schools of thought. Yes. Yes, you have the influence here, you see, of great Greek philosophy and Greek thought very strongly influencing these men. Now, I want to run over a few of these schoolmen that were very prominent. One is Anselm of Canterbury. He was born in Switzerland. Maybe we should give you his dates, 1033 to 1109. Born in Switzerland, his mother was pious, his father was worldly. And as he grew older, he had a real quarrel with his father and left home. He went to Normandy, he studied there, entered the clergy, became a prior of a monastery, and then an abbot. And then in 1093, he succeeded Lanfranc as Archbishop of Canterbury, became Archbishop of Canterbury. And he became involved in this investiture struggle with Henry. And he really took the side of Gregory the VII. He died a peaceful death at 67 years of age. It's said of him that he was one of the ablest and purest men of the medieval church. One of the ablest and purest men. He seemed to have a good testimony. Some have said he was the greatest theologian since Augustine up to this time. The greatest theologian since Augustine. He was an original thinker. He had some profound areas of speculation and thought that he got involved in. Very enthusiastic about monasticism. He wrote several works that were great and had quite an influence in those days. One was the Monologium, and the other was the Proslogium, and these were proofs for God's existence. He was an apologist in this way. Then you have his book, Cur Deus Homo, Why God Became Man. Now he emphasized a childlike faith. And his emphasis was faith precedes knowledge. You can't really know anything until you come to faith. And the center of his theology was love to God. This is the most important thing, love for God. He made two main contributions as far as theology was concerned. One is the existence of God. He had what is called the ontological argument for the existence of God. And Anselm said, you have the idea of a perfect being, and existence is necessary to perfection, therefore God exists. Now, actually, his argument isn't too good, but it had quite an impact in his day. And then he had a view about the atonement. Before Anselm came along, the main view of the atonement was that Christ's death was a ransom paid to Satan. There was a ransom price paid to Satan, and this redeemed people. But Anselm's view was that Christ acquired infinite merit by dying an innocent death. He didn't deserve to die. He died freely, innocently. So he acquired tremendous merit. We can't measure the merit that he acquired by doing this. And this merit now will cover the guilt of the sinner and satisfy God. And this was the view that he advanced, that Anselm advanced, concerning the atonement. Let me read you a few things that Anselm wrote, just a couple of things. He had a tender heart. He wrote this, O good Jesus, how sweet thou art to the heart of him who thinks of thee and loves thee. Again he wrote, O benign Jesus, condescending Lord, holy Master, sweet in mouth, sweet in heart, sweet in ear, inscrutably, unutterably gentle, self-sacrificing, merciful, wise, mighty, most sweet and lovely. And so as you think of Anselm, you think of the fact that he stressed love to God, the center of his theology, and he emphasized faith precedes knowledge. You can't know anything, really, as you should until you come to know God and have faith in him.